From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, getting Michigan in line with the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's a tall order.
That includes our buildings, our facilities, our programs, our parks, our websites, virtually everything that the state of Michigan does and handles.
Plus, Lake Huron gives up a secret she's held since 1861.
We saw these magnificent side wheels standing upright on the floor of Lake Huron, and we realized that there's only one ship left in Lake Huron that's missing that would have been a sidewheel steamer this magnificent size.
And the renaissance of the small bookstore.
We even have the wonderful experience of having people literally walk up to the counter, show us an Amazon thing on their phone, and say, I want this book.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for joining us on this Tuesday. We've seen them rise, then fall, and now rising again. Small independent bookstores are making a comeback in our state. We explore the renaissance on today's show. And then our state is close to wrapping up plans to make itself more accessible to people with disabilities in order to be compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act. We'll talk to the state's compliance director later this hour. But first, she began her career at General Motors as an engineering co-op student in 1980. 33 years later, Mary Barra has made history by being named the next CEO of GM. It's the first time a woman's been placed in the top spot of a major automaker. GM made this groundbreaking announcement today that CEO Dan Akerson is moving up his retirement date to January 15th after discovering his wife is battling cancer, and Mary Barra will succeed him. We're joined now by Michigan Radio's automotive reporter, Tracy Samilton. Welcome back, Tracy.
Thank you.
And from Edmunds.com, always a pleasure to welcome auto analyst Michelle Krebs. Hey, Michelle.
Hey.
So this is quite a breakthrough, that glass ceiling.
Yeah, it
yes,
really
it is.
It really is. It's exciting.
Let's start, if we can, by learning a little more about Mary. Tracy, what has she done overall in her 33 years at GM that has propelled her to this top spot?
Yeah, I think really what has she not done is really the way to phrase the question. Her most recent job in early 2011, she was promoted to head of global product development. And that's a big job. She basically has to make sure the cars are beautiful, well-made, on time, on budget. And then they piled on another job. They put her in charge of global purchasing and supply chain just a year and a half later. And then before that, she was in charge of human resources globally. And then before that, a long string of engineering positions. And she also has been a plant manager.
So, Michelle, how is she regarded, first of all, within General Motors and then throughout the auto industry?
Well, I think inside of General Motors, she's very well regarded. I think there were a lot of cheers today when she was named the CEO. I don't think she's real well known outside of the industry, except by women. And I will tell you that I can guarantee there was cheering among the women executives at other auto companies, because there's a real sense that we need to attract more women to the auto industry. And then, once we get them, make sure they rise through the ranks.
All right. I'd love the thoughts of both of you on this question. Would we have seen a woman being named CEO of General Motors without the bankruptcy crisis? By that, I mean, did all of that blow up the way things had been done, the car guy culture?
I really don't think that had a lot to do with it. Well, you know, it's possible that it did shake up the culture, and certainly Dan Akerson, the current CEO who is stepping down, was a huge advocate for Mary Barra specifically. But, you know, this was going to happen eventually. We may get a woman president of the United States someday. You know, we are seeing women head technical companies in Silicon Valley, so it was bound to happen at some point.
Yeah, and I do attribute this to Dan Akerson coming in. He's an outsider, and he made a point of sort of reaching into GM and finding the best talent. So maybe it wasn't the bankruptcy per se, but he wouldn't have been leading this company if it hadn't been for the bankruptcy, and he definitely had something really specific he wanted to accomplish when he was here at GM.
What if both of you heard about her management style? I mean, there's that kind of common image, if you will, of a female executive being maybe more collaborative than men. Is that true in her case? How does she manage?
Well, she's an engineer first and foremost, so she's very low key. She is someone who approaches things in a very engineering, pragmatic sort of way. My sense is she listens to all the various points of view. She gets a lot of opinions and then makes the decision and gets buy-in from people, which is really important, too.
Yeah, and Dan Akerson mentioned that in terms of her being somebody who would lead a team as opposed to somebody who is a personality. And I think that's exactly what he's getting with Mary.
I think somewhere in all the talk today, I heard some comment that she managed to get engineering, production, and marketing all working together a little more effectively. And is you know, that can be an issue in any company.
Yeah, especially GM with the silos.
Well,
and I'm sure Michelle knows about that.
Industry.
Yeah.
In the automotive industry, you've got this. You know, you can design beautiful cars and you can engineer cars, and then you have to build them. And sometimes the two sides don't, it doesn't work. You could build the most beautiful car in the world. You might not be able to manufacture it. So she's had to bring those sides together.
Michelle, how healthy is the company that Mary Barra will be leading in little more than a month?
Much healthier than it was 5 years ago, and she has seen it through the worst of times. It's far healthier. The pipeline, they've got a lot of product coming out there. I just came from the North American Car and Truck of the Year finalists awards, and at least three of the vehicles are GM products. The pipeline's full. There's more coming. They're making money. They're generating big revenues. They're healthy around the globe. Europe still is the thorn in the side. And what I look at is profit margins. So they're not discounting cars like they used to. Just keep churning them out, discounting them, and not getting good prices and losing money on everyone.
Yeah.
They're making money on cars, even small cars now.
That was auto analyst Michelle Krebs of Edmunds.com, and she's joined by Michigan Radio's automotive reporter Tracy Samilton as we dissect and discuss the really groundbreaking announcement that Mary Barra is going to become the next CEO of General Motors, and this is the first time a woman has been placed in the top spot of a major automaker. I would like to get both of you to give me your thoughts on Dan Akerson's tenure as CEO over these past 3 years. And, of course, just repeating the fact that he's moved up his retirement because his wife is battling cancer, and it's kind of tough to see that happen.
Yeah, it really is. And from my vantage point, I think he's done a great deal, and some of which he hasn't gotten credit for because of his personality. He's not this charismatic figure like Alan Mulally or Sergio Marchionne. So I think the media really hasn't paid as much attention to what he has accomplished as perhaps they should have. But you look at the way the company is operating and you look at the goals they're setting and they're meeting the goals, he's done a lot.
Michelle, where does he fit in your thoughts?
Well, I think he was there's been some skepticism that he didn't really know the car business, but I think the history books will write about him that he stabilized the company and prepared it for the next chapter. And let's remember, the government is now completely out of GM's business as of yesterday. And, now the stage is set for this new generation of managers to run the company.
And with that in mind, there are some shifting and moving of people from positions. Let's talk a little about that. GM North America President Mark Reuss is going to take over Barra's job, yeah?
Yeah,
I think that's a
perfect job for him.
Perfect.
You know, Mark gets so passionate about the products, and now every product that comes out of GM, you know, he is in charge of that. You could not handpick a successor better than Mark getting that job, in my opinion.
And then taking
over. He works well with Mary, I think. They speak highly of each other.
Which has got to be very, very, very important. And then taking over Mark Reuss's job as GM North America president.
Yeah, and I don't know a whole lot about Alan Beatty, but he's got some big shoes to fill because North America is the driver for profits for the company. You know, he's got to make sure that North America keeps going along as well as it was when Mark Reuss was in charge.
And at the same time, he has global experience. He came from Europe, so he brings that perspective.
And then the new company president.
Dan Ammann.
Mm-hmm. And this is interesting. Very strong financial guy. Certainly was a contender for the top spot. What's interesting is this is sort of a back to the history of GM. GM always used to have a product guy, and they financial person as head of the president and CEO of the company. So it's sort of doing that same kind of thing. I think that's a nice balance.
All right. In our final minute, I'm going to start. We'll do a lightning round here. What do each of you see as the biggest challenges Mary will face as CEO? Tracy, go.
She's got to keep those products coming out fast, and they have to be very high quality. She has to make sure that those things come out of the pipe done right.
And Michelle?
Well, that and fixing Europe. It's going to take a miracle worker to do that, and they've had a lot of false starts in terms of how they're going to turn that around. But that's the biggest drag at General Motors right now.
Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio's automotive reporter, and Michelle Krebs, analyst with Edmunds.com. As always, a pleasure to talk cars with both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, after 152 years, shipwreck hunters find the missing steamboat, the Keystone State. Then we'll learn why some independent bookstores are making a comeback.
Without a bookstore to actually promote various authors, then all you're left with is an algorithm, which simply says people who bought Harry Potter also bought John Grisham. Mm-hmm. Reading is a very, very personal thing. And if you can find someone who understands your taste, understand who you are, then that's your bookseller, and you want that person to help you find books.
That story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been a mystery that has haunted Lake Huron since the Civil War. What happened to the Keystone State? The wooden steamer set out from Detroit, bound for Milwaukee, around November 9, 1861. She never made it. And no one knew the Keystone State had run into trouble until wreckage washed up on the shore near Lexington. Thanks to my next guest, the Keystone State is a mystery no longer. She's been found, albeit in nearly 175 feet of water. David Trotter is a veteran shipwreck hunter. Through his company, Undersea Research Associates, he has combed through nearly 2,000 miles of Great Lakes bottomland and found nearly 100 lost vessels. David Trotter, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you.
So tell us what was known about the Keystone State. What do we know about that final voyage?
Well, we know that she got up off of what is called the Thumb of Michigan, the tip of the thumb where Port Austin is located, and we know that she was sighted at that point, and she was considered to be disabled and in rolling conditions, meaning, of course, that she was trying to make her way up the lake, caught in this gale, and in this gale come across from the west across toward the east and was buffeting her tremendously along the side of the ship, so she was rocking and rolling. Now, the side wheels at that point would begin to come in and out of the water, further making control of the vessel much more difficult. And literally, she disappeared for 10 or 12 days before there was some remains found floating on the lake and eventually further down toward Port Huron. So there was a big window of 8 to 10, 12 days where nobody had any idea what had happened to the Keystone State.
And there were 33 on board.
Yes, there were the captain, Captain Travers, and 32 crew that were on board that intended to, of course, make Milwaukee. Now, our discovery of her answered some questions but left others unanswered. And certainly we now realize that she had a tremendous fight to try and save her life as they continued up north against this gale force storm. And in doing so, she no doubt began to suffer some damage. And I can just, we can picture what happened at that point based on accounts that have happened to other vessels that we're aware of, that they would have been stoking the boilers at all costs to keep the fire going so that the paddle wheels would turn, and also so that the bilge pumps would continue to work to pour water back out that no doubt was leaking inside the hull.
Hmm.
And finally, at some point, they would have realized that their cargo was causing them trouble, and you would have had much of the crew trying to pitch all of the cargo over the side in an effort to make the ship more seaworthy. And eventually, the water would have gotten to the fireboxes that stoked the boilers, and the fire would have went out, and then they were really at the mercy of this very horrific storm. And they would have all climbed up on the upper decks and started to throw parts of the ship overboard in an effort to be able to jump and cling to them. And finally, when the ship disappeared and sunk very abruptly, there would have been what we call the uppers, or the more fragile parts of the ship that would have floated to the surface. And crew and the captain may well have grabbed a hold of those in an effort to save themselves. But literally, the cold water of November would have eventually sapped their strength, and they would have, they all perished. And in fact, we never did find it. We did not find any human remains, nor were there any found back in 1861.
You really paint a story that is, it gives me goosebumps as you talk. I'm sure all of us listening are you know, thinking of movies we've seen, whether it be Titanic or The Perfect Storm. But that idea of being out there in the middle of a maritime storm and there is nothing, and there's nothing there for you.
Yeah, there is. The ship is their only hope because they have no lifeboats. There's no other ships that see them. And as they were heading north into this storm, the paddle wheels, as I mentioned, or the side wheels, of course, didn't operate particularly well as the ship was rolling and pitching. So she was actually getting pushed further out into the middle of Lake Huron. And the further she got pushed out, the more graphic and difficult the wave conditions would have been. So she was fighting a losing battle as she could not control herself and come in closer to shore for protection. And eventually, of course, that caused her demise. But nobody knew where she went. It was a 50-mile run between the last time she was seen and where we actually located her.
Really? So when did you find her and how?
We found her in early July, and I was doing some what we call searching or rec hunting, survey work that looks for things that are on the bottom that are missing. And I've done this for about 35 years as an avocation. It's a chance to document marine history, to share the excitement of discovering exploration, and really make people much more aware of our Michigan history regarding the Great Lakes.
So you found her, and she was about 40 to 50 miles from where she was last seen. So it was quite an agonizing fight, wasn't it?
Well, it certainly was. And certainly we know today where she's at, but if one can picture that information, of course, you know, not available a year ago. So if you did all your research, you would assume that she was off of the Thumb. And I have done extensive survey off the Thumb and fully expected that I could have found her 20 years ago instead of finding her this last July.
And where exactly did you find her, David?
About 30 miles northeast of Harrisville, or off. Another way to say it is generally off of Alpena.
Oh, boy.
To give you a sense of where that's at compared to where the Thumb of Michigan is when she was last sighted.
I have to ask you, it's one of my few chances to really talk to someone who has discovered a lost ship, has seen it. What does that feel like? What thoughts are going through your mind, first of all, when your sonar device says there's something here, and then you actually see that ship that's been, in this case, lost since 1861?
Well, certainly when a target appears on the side scan, we are fairly confident that it may be what we're looking for, but you're never too sure. We call them an anomaly, meaning that it has characteristics of the type of thing we're looking for, the object, in this instance a shipwreck. And it's only upon when we close in and expand the detail by closing in onto the site and making the whole thing expand on our screen that we get a greater sense of what she might be. And in this instance, we saw these magnificent side wheels standing upright on the floor of Lake Huron, and we realized that there was only one ship left in Lake Huron that was missing that would have been a sidewheel steamer this magnificent size, and it would be the Keystone State. So you put a team of divers down the next few weeks, and they're the first to touch this site and to swim back into history over after 150 years. And it's quite an emotional experience for everybody that participates.
What kind of emotions?
Well, you realize that there was a tremendous struggle and that there were people whose future was very bleak as they attempted to continue to keep this ship floating. And you now realize that this is a site that represents a very significant loss to those people as well as the families back in 1861.
Great Lakes underwater explorer David Trotter. All the details on his latest discovery, the Keystone State, can be found on his website. It's shipwreck1, and that's the number 1.com. David Trotter, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today on Stateside.
thank you for calling.
Remember You've Got Mail, the Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan romantic comedy? Writer-director Nora Ephron said she was trying to speak out about the little independent bookstores like Meg Ryan's Shop Around the Corner being crushed by the big chain bookstore, Tom Hanks's Fox Books.
A Fox Books superstore.
Kel nightmare.
It has nothing to do with us. It's big, impersonal, overstocked, and full of ignorant salespeople.
But they discount.
Well, that was in 1998. And indeed, many small independent bookstores were fighting for their lives in face of the big chain stores. Now in 2013, the bookselling landscape has changed. Borders Books collapsed, of course, in 2011, and Barnes & Noble had to close many of its stores. There is Amazon, with its talk of using drones to drop your order at your door in just a few short years. But guess what? Independent small bookstores are enjoying something of a renaissance. We wanted to talk about this, so as we welcome Deborah Leonard, who's director of the Great Lakes Independent Booksellers Association. Good to have you with us, Deb.
Sure, glad to be here.
And from Traverse City, we're joined by Peter Makin, who owns Brilliant Books. Hello, Peter.
Good afternoon.
Very good to have you with us. Deborah, is it a fair statement to make that independent bookstores are indeed doing better?
They certainly seem to be. In the Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti area, we have three brand new bookstores this year. And that, I think it's been quite some time since there have been new bookstores opening. The American Booksellers Association, which is a national nonprofit that supports independent bookstores, is almost up to 2,000 members again, and it's been about 7 years since they've had that many stores. So things are looking up.
So you're seeing businesses hanging on and also new businesses opening.
And not only that, one thing that's happening is that it's exciting is that when people are retiring and selling their stores, younger people are buying them. There had been a period where if you wanted to sell your store, no one was interested and you pretty much had to close. But again, in my region, I've had three very nice bookstores go to younger owners in the last couple of years. So that's really exciting as well.
Going to a good home.
Going to a good home, yes.
Peter, how long have you had Brilliant Books?
Well, Brilliant Books, in its in all its incarnations, has been around now for 6 years. But we've only had a store where we are now in Traverse City for the last two. We were previously in Suttons Bay for 5 years.
Are you noticing an increase in people who do want to buy local and who come in and would rather pick up a book as opposed to click on their computer?
Oh, yes. In fact, we even have the wonderful experience of having people literally walk up to the counter, show us an Amazon thing on their phone and say, I want this book. And so they're making a decision. They want to rather support a local community-based store than simply clicking their button. Because I think, it goes to a much larger theme that's really happening within many communities in our area, which is that people want to, they understand that if they spend money at a local store, they're keeping the money in that zone. The money they spend with me stays here in Traverse City, stays on the Leelanau Peninsula. It doesn't just disappear into the pockets of corporate executives wherever they might be. And I think people are understanding that. They understand that they want their local economy to thrive. They need to keep the money where they live.
There have been many studies, but a few years ago they did a study that found out that if you spend $100 in a community in a local store, 68 of it goes back into that community and 43 from a chain. And, of course, if you shop online, zero goes back into the local economy. And I think people really are starting to realize that if you don't shop there, these stores won't be there anymore.
So it seems that that customers are getting the sense it's not enough to smile as they go buy Brilliant Books and go, boy, I'm glad they're here. You have to come in
exactly. And
buy a book from Peter.
Yes.
I think that's right. I think that's what we're seeing. I said not only in bookstores. I think bookstores are, if you like, the sort of we get to be the sort of poster child for community shopping because we saw that great demise through the big dot-com boom. But as you know, these wonderful numbers that Deb's just given us, it's quite extraordinary because when I first opened a bookstore, it was in years of great decline. I think I probably opened my store as the whole bookstore industry hit rock bottom, and from then on, it's been every year everything's moved upwards. In terms of the numbers of stores opening and simply, I think, communities like here in Traverse City, we have two independent bookstores within a couple of blocks of each other. And that says something about the community that we live in.
Now, are you getting any help from publishers? Because it would be my sense that publishers would, as much as they're selling books through, let's say, an online company like Amazon, it's in their best interest to help folks like you stay alive.
Yeah, I think that they're really seeing that, and I'm sure that Deb can also add to this, that without a bookstore to actually promote various authors, then all you're left with is an algorithm, which simply says people who bought Harry Potter also bought John Grisham, mm-hmm. you know, which really doesn't tell you much, except that both of those are very popular books. But if you actually go into a bookstore and you talk to a bookseller, someone who has a passion for books, and that person really gets to know who you are, your taste, the kind of things that you like to read, they can put a book into your hand that you would not have noticed before. You wouldn't have come across, and you certainly wouldn't find it through an algorithm. And I think that's really what makes the difference. Reading is a very, very personal thing. And if you can find someone who understands your taste, understands who you are, then that's your bookseller, and you want that person to help you find books.
Deb, are you seeing the members in the Great Lakes Independent Booksellers Association incorporating technology and keeping up with technological developments, not only in reading but in marketing?
It is true, especially in the last couple of years. Facebook has been really big. Twitter, they really have stepped up their game in that. Most of my stores have websites, and a lot of my stores also sell ebooks. I don't know if people know that when you buy a Kindle, a brand Kindle, not the like Kleenex Kindle, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but a brand Kindle, you can only buy ebooks from Amazon. You can't buy them from anybody else, so you're locked into a closed loop. There are other e-readers out there that are really good. The Nook from Barnes & Noble, you can buy books from everybody. And then the Kobo, which is actually the largest e-reader in the world outside of the United States. And you can buy books for both of those through independent bookstores who sell
Now, what
e-books.
About, I'll just ask, what about the iPad?
iPad, yes. You can,
okay.
Yes. It's only the Kindle that's the closed loop.
What would you say you're doing it day in and day out there in Traverse City at Brilliant Books, Peter Makin, the biggest challenges you face in 2013 in running your bookstore?
Well, I think the biggest challenges really still are there are still a lot of folks out there for whom the discount is the most important thing, and I think we're seeing less of that as the economy improves and people realize that it's books we're selling. We're not selling, if it's an automobile and you can maybe save $5,000-$7,000 on it, then you might want to shop around. But if it's a hardcover book and you're saving a few bucks, and what you would save means the demise of a bookstore that you love, it simply isn't worth it. But there are still some folks for whom the lowest possible price ever has to be the thing. But I think we're seeing nationally a change to that.
I agree with that, exactly. Now, you had asked earlier about what things publishers are doing.
Yeah.
They are doing quite a few things now to help out the independent bookstores. They seem to be working a little bit more, trying to get more local authors out into stores. There was something that happened on Small Business Saturday, the Saturday after Thanksgiving, that was very cool. Sherman Alexie, who is an author, he's the author of the absolutely true story of a part-time Indian. Thank you. And he said, why don't authors that support local bookstores go and work there on that Saturday? And over 1,000 authors around the country worked in bookstores, selling books, wrapping books, just talking to people. And that's not something you can get online. So they really are trying to give us more opportunities for things that are unique to locally owned stores.
We've been speaking with Deborah Leonard, who's director of the Great Lakes Independent Booksellers Association. And from Traverse City, we've been speaking with Peter Makin, owner of Brilliant Books. And Peter, I look forward to checking out your store the next time I'm in Traverse City.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for talking with us, both of you, today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And coming up, the state is close to wrapping up plans to make itself more accessible to people with disabilities and to be compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act. We'll talk to the state's compliance director. And then we find out why some college grads find it difficult to change their appearance in order to land a job. That story in 15 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. The state of Michigan is close to wrapping up plans to make itself more accessible to people with disabilities. The goal is to get state offices, communications, buildings, websites to be compliant with the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. We wanted to get a better idea of what that really looks like and how much progress has been made. Joining us is Laura Hall, who's an assistive technology coordinator for the Michigan Disability Rights Coalition. And she's joined by Sharon Ellis, who is the state ADA compliance director. Sharon, I'd like to start with you. Your position was actually created by Governor Snyder last year. What's your mission and what kind of resources have you been given?
my mission is to, first of all, make sure that everything within the state that not, well, I want to say that the state of Michigan does, is compliant with the state and federal Americans with Disabilities Act. That includes our buildings, our facilities, our programs, our parks, our websites, virtually everything that the state of Michigan does and handles is accessible to our customers and our employees with disabilities.
And I guess kind of going back, really predating when Governor Snyder, well, long before Governor Snyder became our governor and you came into the office, the question kind of has to be raised with the ADA having been passed in 1990. What's your understanding of why all these years later there are still areas where the state wasn't compliant?
Well, there have been updates to the Act, and there have been updates to the Act, and there are all sorts of reasons why buildings might not be compliant. There are historic exceptions, and there are all sorts of, I never want to use the term grandfathered because there are no relatives in the ADA, but there are many reasons why buildings might not have to be up to compliance, because a building might have been built so long ago that it doesn't have to meet the standards. But if you do any remodeling in the building, then the building must be brought up to compliance, whatever the most recent version of the Act is.
And it certainly seems like it is a real, real tall order to monitor.
Yeah.
Laura, from the point of view of the Michigan Disability Rights Coalition, what do you see as major areas of concern with state of Michigan programs and websites and all of that not being compliant?
Well, I think when you're looking at the perspective from people with disabilities, people with disabilities want to be involved in their communities and their governments just as any other person would want to be involved in their community and governments. So people with disabilities want to have access to employment within the state of Michigan. They want to be able to have voting access and have impact on legislative measures that are taken, have their voices heard in the legislators about legislation that's going to impact them, access to parks and recreation and all things, just as other people would want that access as well.
I know, Sharon, the state brought in an outside firm recently for an audit. What did they find?
We did an audit of our DTMB, and I should express what that is. That is our Department of Technology Management and Budget. That is our administrative department, which oversees many of the things in state government, but particularly our buildings and our facilities. And the buildings that that department manages is just about 40 buildings. What they found, and I can't go into, you know, every single detail.
Oh, sure.
But they did certainly find that some of our buildings had some issues with compliance. And so we are in the process right now of reviewing all of that information. And we are then going to prioritize everything that we found and within every building. And then we are going to go about starting to fix everything.
So give me an idea.
It's going to take a while, as you might imagine.
Sure. Well, and as you say, there were issues. Give me an idea of what issues exist.
Well, for instance, there might be a restroom that is not compliant. Now, all of our buildings do have accessible restrooms, but we found that in some buildings, the stalls, they may be several inches out of compliance. But that means we're out of compliance.
Okay.
So that's not going to be the highest priority, as you might imagine. However, when we find that there is an entrance to a building that is not accessible, that is an extremely high priority, because our priority is first get people in the building. That is the most important thing. We must have accessible entrances. People must be able to get into the building, and then we go down from there. But I want to emphasize that when something made the list, it may have made the list because a door jam was a half an inch off. But that is how detailed we got.
And what about websites? Because this has to be a very, very important avenue
Indeed.
For handicapped and disabled
now,
people.
That was not part of the audit.
Okay.
Because the audit just limited itself to our buildings and, by the way, signage. We are also working on signage both in and out of our buildings. So we are working on exterior signage and wayfinding issues as well as interior signage. We want all of our signage to be consistent in terms of size and coloring and braille, because some of our signage does not include braille at this point. So that's a very high priority as well. But back to the website question.
Yes.
We have so many websites that it's hard to keep track of the number.
Under the Michigan.gov, yeah.
Well, not just under Michigan.gov. We have a number of other kinds of websites that some are accessible and at this point some are not. Back in the summer, I'm sorry to say that our Michigan.gov websites were at about 33% accessible.
So you set the tech teams at it, and where do you stand now?
We are near 100%, and that was just over 4 months.
Laura Hall, what does that mean, the idea of having these websites accessible, Laura Hall? What needs to be there for folks to be able to use them?
Well, in terms of what it means that people have access to information on websites, to getting the resources that they need in Michigan, filling out applications for assistance, all sorts of things, being able to access their local polling sites, what they need through the Secretary of State, all of those type of things. So in terms of what the websites need in terms of accessibility, there's definitely the standards that Sharon talked about definitely provide some guidance in terms of how to structure those websites so that they're accessible to people who have low vision, who use screen readers, and things like that. Just in terms of font size, of contrast, of being able to adjust the font size, how things are labeled on the website so that they're accessible to screen readers. And one question that I had for you, Sharon, is as you're going through this process with the information technology, have you, I know there are some ways to evaluate web accessibility, and I'm sure that you've gone through those sites. Have you also conducted some usability studies with people with disabilities to see exactly how they're working for them and whether they're able to access them in the way that you intend them to?
Yes, Laura. We do have a very close working relationship with the Bureau of Services for Blind Persons. One of the things that we've been doing in that regard is we're almost done creating an accessible online menu that our vendors, we have vendors in all the buildings that have either cafeterias or little vendor stands, and we are creating a website where they can put up their menus every day so that their customers can access to see what they're serving every day or if they're offering specials or anything. And we expect that site to launch next month. There's never been anything like that before. So we're very excited about that, as is the Bureau and the vendors. We do have something that we use called look and feel standards. Mm-hmm. So there is a list, a checklist of things that every website must pass before it can launch.
I'm interested of the thoughts from both of you. Sharon Ellis is the state ADA compliance director, and Laura with the Michigan Disability Rights Coalition. Is meeting the Americans with Disabilities Act standards enough, or are there aspects of living with a disability that are not addressed by the ADA? Laura, I'll let you take that first.
Sure. Well, I am a person with a disability myself, and I use a wheelchair. So I have some firsthand experience with accessibility issues and inclusion issues. And as much as I would like to say that we could have a legislation that would take care of all the access issues and all the inclusion issues for people with disabilities, really I just don't think that we can say that the ADA can take care of all of those issues. No matter how good of legislation we have, it's never going to remove all barriers for people with disabilities, because so many of the barriers have to do with just societal attitudes for disability, in terms of employment. I know that people with disabilities still have an unemployment rate of over 70%, and there certainly have been efforts to create better access to employment for people with disabilities. But until, you know, we can work with employers and have them understand that, you know, people with disabilities have the same talents and skills as people without disabilities, and help them understand how to provide low-cost accommodations. You know, most people don't understand or aren't aware, but most accommodations in the workplace cost under $50 to make those accommodations for people with disabilities. So, I mean, until we can kind of break through some of those attitudinal barriers and societal barriers, you know, the ADA really isn't going to cover some of those things that are more institutional based.
Sharon, your thoughts.
I agree with Laura that I just can't imagine any legislation that could ever be written that could take care of breaking down all the barriers. That's why there needs to be so much more done, and that's why, for instance, I'm glad Laura brought up the issue of employment, because, for instance, Governor Snyder has really made ADA compliance and the ADA itself a priority. Last month, he held his second annual Governor's Disability Summit, which is focused on assisting Michigan businesses in hiring people with disabilities. There were keynote speakers, and one of the things that they addressed is just exactly what Laura was talking about. It really doesn't cost much at all in terms of equipment, in terms of training, in terms of anything to hire people with disabilities. It's just a matter, again, of raising awareness. And once that awareness is raised, people are thrilled with the people with disabilities that they've hired. They find that they are exemplary employees and can't wait to hire more, actually. So it really is not just ever a reliance on legislation.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a team effort from legislators themselves to government officials like Governor Snyder. It really is just getting out there and spreading the word.
That was Sharon Ellis, the state ADA compliance director, and she was joined by Laura Hall, an assistive technology coordinator for the Michigan Disability Rights Coalition. Thanks to both of you for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Cindy, so much.
We spend a big chunk of our lives in school, but as we find out, the educational system and the real world are two different places. In school, there are rules. Everyone has the chance to get an A, no matter what you look like. But that idea of fairness changes in the real world. We asked some college students what would happen if their boss told them they had to change the way they look.
If I walked into my job on the first day of work and my boss told me I needed to change the way I looked, I would say right back to them, this is not appropriate.
I would be offended because that's like an attack on who I am.
I would probably just listen to what he's saying and then not do that.
For people at their first job out of college, it could be a slap in the face to learn that your appearance is often just as important as your abilities. Stateside's Lucy Perkins has this story about one young woman who learned just that.
In the beginning, it seemed like a pretty good gig. Haley Foydell graduated from the University of Michigan last spring, and in June she moved to New York for her first job out of college. They gave her bonuses, and her contract promised her expensive suits. But things changed quickly when a manager approached her on her first day of work, even though she was following their dress code and wearing professional business attire.
I was just sat down by this woman and told, you know, your shoes are not shiny enough. Your pants are a quarter of an inch too short. You, like, look like a slob.
Foydell was training to be a restaurant manager at a corporate restaurant management company.
I was told that I would be expected to wear mascara, eyeliner, eyeshadow, blush, and lipstick every single day, none of which I felt comfortable doing.
Foydell tried to talk to her HR representative. She told her how uncomfortable the makeup requirement made her feel, but nothing changed. The next week, one of her bosses suggested she go to a high-end makeup store and get a makeover. But Foydell doesn't wear makeup, and she didn't want to start. After a month of working without blush or eyeshadow, she was fired. The company did not respond to requests for comment. Dana Muir is a professor of business law at the University of Michigan. She says this kind of treatment might seem unfair, but it's perfectly legal.
And under our basic rule of employment at will, typically an employer could fire someone on any given day for not wearing makeup, even if they didn't have a specific set of grooming standards in place.
Employment at will is part of federal labor law. Think about the job you have now. You chose to work there, and you can always choose to leave. But your boss can also choose to fire you.
It might be perfectly legal, but it might not be very smart.
That's Eric Peterson. He's a senior consultant at Cook Ross, a company that teaches business people about unconscious bias in the workplace. Peterson says that companies that make a job dependent on a worker's appearance might actually be turning away talent, and that might create a culture that's not inclusive of different kinds of people. He also says that keeping requirements equal for men and women are a big part of making a workplace inclusive.
And I might point out to them that as a woman working in this particular organization, what you're saying is, guys, the face that nature gave you is great. Women, not so much. You look hideous, quite frankly, and you need to cover that up with some artificial substances that make you look like something that wasn't exactly found in nature.
Peterson says companies do it because they probably think they'll make more money. But that attitude might not reflect their customers' values. And if a company doesn't reflect its customers, it won't be in touch with them. And that could be bad for their bottom line. Haley Foydell, the aspiring restaurant manager we met earlier, says that what happened in New York taught her a lot about what values she looks for in a workplace.
In a really conservative company like this, I suddenly had to be like, hey, listen, like, I'm not this, like, feminine woman who's about to say, okay, I'll wear more eyeliner to work.
Foydell decided to get out of the corporate restaurant world. Now she's applying for internships and jobs in the Washington, D.C. area. She says her experience in that first job out of college was tough, but it ultimately showed her what she's willing to do and not do for her career. For Stateside, I'm Lucy Perkins.
Our show today was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Lucy Perkins, Katie Suha, Claire Tanisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.